listening to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
You're listening to the DC Public Library on Full Service Radio, broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. This episode is part of All Things Local, where we highlight D.C. history, culture, and communities, and Washingtonians who have made an impact on our city. I'm your host, Victor Benitez. I'm a librarian at the Shaw Library. Today, I'm joined by our co-host, Ray Barker, Maurice Jackson, and on the phone, we have Lauren Sinclair. Hello, everyone.
How are you?
All right. Thank you.
Well, great, Maurice. Thanks for joining us today. This is Ray. I have a list of questions for you, Maurice, about the new publication. That's why we're speaking with him today. And as Victor said, Lauren will chime in as needed when she feels like it. And we've got some questions for her. So a little non-traditional approach today, which is great. But Maurice, I thought we'd start talking about how I've been kind of tracking the activity with the book. I mean, it was published, I think, just over a month ago by Georgetown University Press. You know, you've read with Judith Corey and Bridget Arnwine at Politics and Prose a couple of Sundays ago out at Connecticut Avenue. And then Rusty Hassan, one of the other contributors, and you were at Busboys and Poets in Tacoma Park this past Sunday. And then you were with Bobby Hill, his show on WOWD with Bill Worrell, Saturday. So I feel like I need like a map with little points and I can just follow you that way. Have you been that busy in promoting this since it came out?
Well, you know, I'm one of those people who don't sleep much, so I do what I can.
You know? You're going through the McDonald's drive-through.
No, I don't do that.
At 3 a.m. talking about the book. I'm teasing you.
No, but you know, let me just say it's very interesting being here in this neighborhood. This is sort of where I came to adulthood, right around the corner. So when I first came to Washington and came to go to college, it's just very interesting to see the neighborhood. And sometimes you know, development, you know, I've written a lot about it, but, you know, sometimes development can be good. And this looks like an example of development with a purpose where it serves the community, but it's not putting anybody out in the street because this building had been vacant for years. And right around the corner was the Showboat, which was one of the great nightclubs of Washington, D.C. we've been delighted. You know, it's about eight or nine of us who put together this book. I and Blair Rubel co-edited it. I'm a professor of 17th and 18th century Atlantic history, which means the history of revolutions in the world in African America and France. And Blair's a historian of Russian history. And so we both have a love of jazz, and we were able to put together seven, eight other people. Dr. Sinclair was on the phone, did an article on Howard University. Dr. Judith Curry did an article on UDC. Willard Jenkins, who was the artistic director of the DC Jazz Festival, interviewed Bill Brower, who's a longtime producer. So, and Bridget Arnwine on Women in Jazz, John Hassay, the expert on Duke Ellington. So we had about seven, eight people. So there's enough people to go around to speak. The question is, sharing that microphone. It's very hard, you know, when you have so many people in one mic, but we do okay.
Right. And Victor, if you don't mind, then so how has the book been received?
Well, you know, beyond my imagination, if I could say, you know, Duke Ellington, beyond category, it's very unusual for a book to have two readings at one place in one day, at the, both Politics and Prose in one day. They had never had it in all the years that they've been there. I've written other books, and I've had one at one place or another, but never, you know, two at a time. And then to do it again at Busboys, and we'll be at Sankofa, we'll be at State Street, we'll be at Kramer's. In the fall, we'll have a big event at AU with the Metropolitan Policy Institute. In the fall, the president of Georgetown will host an event for the book. We'll have an event at UW. So I'm just elated. You know, I spent many years traveling the world. So I don't yearn to travel around, go around the city, countries I did with a couple of other books. I'm very happy just to be here because I have other projects to finish. And so when I travel, I can do what I want.
Yeah, and Maurice, you mentioned doing these back-to-back author talks. What kind of people are coming out to hear you?
Well, you know, I've been in D.C. a long time, and I've had many lives. I was an activist for many years. I was a construction worker. I've done, and the first event at Parks and Pills, I had friends who came out I hadn't seen in years, friends who played soccer with my kids, friends who I worked construction with at the Smithsonian, friends who I knew from just going to jazz clubs. And then it was just delightful. And so they've been jazz lovers, but they've also been people who want to know about D.C. They've been people who know nothing about jazz, but want to know more about community. And every different crowd is different. We've been just very gratified that the great Andrew White, one of the great legends of D.C. Right. music, has come out twice. The other day we had Judy Richardson, who was one of the real heroes of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, who came out. We've had activists, we've had city leaders, and just many others. And the book is when we go to the bookstore, I've gone to a couple of bookstores just in front before, just as I'm passing home, and they say, "Well, you mind signing books?" And I've just signed books and just signed them, and they're really? Gone before. So we are very pleased with. And I should tell the listener that the foreword is written by the artistic director of the Kennedy Center of Jazz, mm-hmm. Jason Moran, who I've just brought to do the same thing at Georgetown, where he gives 2 lectures a semester. And he has the foreword, and then we'll have a special session on October 3rd just on D.C. Jazz at Georgetown, a free performance. Performance discussion with Jason Moran and myself and others.
Cool. And I was just going to plug, the library is hoping to get Maurice in for an author talk sometime in July at the Shaw Library, so please keep an eye out for that. Can we dig in a little bit? I had one more follow-up question, if we could dig into your section, Maurice, in the book. But the origins of the book itself, it originally started through a smaller publication at Georgetown. Is that right? The essays, some of them?
Well, no. What happened was that someone called me up one day from a publisher and asked me would I write a book on jazz in Baltimore. And I said I would if I could, but I can't. And I knew, because great musicians have come out of Baltimore, Ethel Lennis, Uwe Blake, many others. But I couldn't do that. And so I said, what about a book on D.C.? They said, well, there's no interest. And I didn't believe that. So luckily, I was a fellow at the Woodrow Wilson Center. And Blair Rubel was there as a Russian scholar, and he and I started talking, and I said, let me approach the Historic Society of Washington. They have a magazine. So they turned over a special issue, but the catch was I had to raise the money for the publication. Mm-hmm. So I knew a lady who named Mrs. Mika Erdogan, whose husband was Ahmet Erdogan, the Turkish man who founded Atlantic Records. So she funded the issue itself. So after the issue was released, it sold out. It just sold wonderfully.
And this is the Historical Society of
Historical
Washington.
Historical Society of Washington. Yeah. And it is a wonderful, in fact, it has even more pictures than this, because you could do the pictures in a magazine. So anyway, it ran out. And so I said, why don't you reprint it? So they said, well, will you raise more money? I said, no, I'm done. I'm not raising. So, but I wanted it to come out in book form. So I went to Georgetown University Press, where I teach. And they said, oh, I don't know if it'd be any interest. And so I said, I bet it will. So I drummed up some support. And then I had done a study for the city on why so many African Americans were being forced out of the city. And it caught the president's attention. So we were able to get the support of the university. And so the University Press published, if you look on the back of the book, President John DeGioia has written a wonderful blurb. And on the back of the book, the great, one of my dear friends, Randy Weston, one of the legends of jazz, 95 years old, who plays all over the world, including especially the music of the Gnawa people in Morocco, has a beep. So we put that together, and sometimes fate, sometimes things just work out.
Yeah, Maurice, why do you think people were telling you that there wouldn't be any interest in this sort of book?
Oh, everybody's not as smart as you are, you see. Everybody's not as smart as Ray is. So sometimes, and I tell people, just listen. I'll never tell you anything unless I think it's right. And if I say it, then take it to the bank. I'm not going to say it unless I think it's absolutely correct. It's not boastful. It's just true. I'm a truthful cat. So, and I talked to them and I said, tell me if something you're going to publish or more. But then the magazine had done so well. And then they went and looked at that and read. And I told them about all the people. The magazine did so well amongst that. But, you know, when you write, when you edit a magazine, you get a small piece of money, not much. So I took every penny that I had in it and just bought other issues and mailed it to every musician in New York that I knew from D.C. And these are great: Billy Hart, Jimmy Cobb, Bruce Williams, many others. And so we just brought copies and sent it to them. So it had a big impact, and musicians loved it because we were speaking about their music. It wasn't about us. The only time you hear a person talk about themselves is in interviews with people. We have a section, and that's understandable. But it's not about us. It's about a greater something. And it's about how music can help heal the soul, but also how it can help bring people together to do good. Those say good things happen when good people do things together, and that's what we want you to do.
And Maurice, can we dive a little bit more into this, sure. Into your section? It's titled Jazz, and in quotes, Great Black Music and the Struggle for Racial and Social Equality in Washington, D.C. And so Andrew White, who is a photograph of him in here, but he's been coming to the events, as you said. But one of the comments Andrew had about the book was, in the talk, was that it's not just about the music, it's about the sort of broader cultural implications. And then your piece in particular really drills down into the racial segregation history independent of the music, but it's also sort of intertwined too, if I have some of that right. But yeah, can you talk about a little bit about that history?
Well, sure. And I use the term great black music, which is a term came up from the Art Ensemble of Chicago and others in the 70s. And it meant that jazz, that the music of African Americans is not as bifurcated as some think. And so it included the music that comes out of the Negro spiritual, out of classical music and all others. And from the very beginning, when African Americans wanted to perform music in Washington, it was in segregated places. They could not get classical training in other places outside. And Dr. Sinclair would later talk about Howard. But our music served as a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick souls. So a biblical verse goes. And so music did that. It helped bring people together. It helped in the dark nights. And so African Americans in Washington took just the Negro spirituals, but jazz picked up. Jazz is an unusual form. How did it start? We suppose that it started around the time of the Civil War, when Confederate soldiers left their German fifes in the field. They left their bugle in the field, and Africans went and picked those up and started playing those instruments. They went to Congo Square, and they started playing in congregational form, call and response, very much as in church music. And African Americans did this. Then we see the merging of classical music. A man named Will Marion Cook, who was classically trained. In fact, Frederick Douglass paid for part of his training at Oberlin. And we see the mixing of another man named James Reach Europe out of Mobile, Alabama, who comes to Washington at the age of 10 and goes to Dunbar, and how they joined together. And how in music class, and if the listener is a bit familiar with Washington, D.C. history, you'll find James Reach Europe is in the same class with Sterling Brown, the great poet of Washington, with William Hasty, who was one of the first black judges, with Charles Drew, the inventor of blood plasma. So all these people are playing this music as a form of togetherness. And I talk in the chapter how a period of times James Reach Europe took his music to Europe and with the Harlem Hellfighters. And other forms here, how Marian Anderson in 1939 brought singing at Constitution Hall when she was denied the right by the Daughters of the American Revolution who owned Constitution Hall, but how people like Eleanor Roosevelt joined in with her, how Billie Holiday came here and sang Strange Fruit at the Club Ballet and the Urban League and other black institutions of upper-class institutions did not like this because she was singing about mansions, but she had the courage to do that. How Duke Ellington is from Washington, D.C., and it inspires him in his music. So as he writes about the black bond and braids, about the Battle of Savannah, where Africans fought with Haitians to win salvation in the Civil War. And all the way down through Willis Conover. And then I tell the story of these Turkish brothers, two men born in Turkey, went to England with their father. Our father comes to the United States as the second ambassador under the Ataturk administration. The Ataturk administration is the administration that made secularism the law of the land in Turkey. And how they wanted to go hear music. They'd heard Ella Fitzgerald at the Palladium in London. And so they wanted to go. The only place you can go is nightclubs at night. The father didn't want them to do that. So he says, bring the musicians here to my house. As the Bible goes, in my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would not have told you. And he said, I will tell you, bring them to my mansion, bring them to my house. And they brought the musicians there, Black, White, Curly Russell, all the, some of the great ones, Louis Jordan. And as they play there, some of the bigoted senators get very angry. You can't blame those black men and women in this place. They came through the front door. And Ambassador says, in my house, everyone will come through the front, in my mansion. If you want to go through the back, you may. And so they came and they started playing. And then these Turkish brothers, they're Muslim. And here's these Muslim brothers take black music to 16th and R Street. What's there? The Jewish Community Center. So Muslims take black music to a Jewish. And I often say, if we had this type of cooperation amongst people today, we'd be much in better shape. But we're not in very good shape because we don't have that type cooperation.
Yeah, and the music kind of binding people together independent of their religion or race or whatever, right?
I think so.
And then I was going to transition into Lauren, if Lauren's available. Lauren, can you hear us?
Hi, yeah, I can hear you.
Oh, hey. So this is Lauren Sinclair, and her essay is No Church Without a Choir, about the music program history at Howard. And just to remind you, Lauren is a faculty member at American University in the School of Professional and Extended Studies, and also played violin, if I'm reading this correctly, in the Howard University Symphony Orchestra.
That's correct.
Great. So we're speaking to Lauren from Los Angeles, and her essay is the last one in the book of 10 essays. But so transitioning somewhat gracefully, maybe not so, to talking about the history of Howard and how it began in 1867, but the founding of the music department, you say in your essay, had sort of a, in quote, slow and modest start. Can you talk about sort of the beginnings of that program? And I know it transitioned into classical and then jazz, right?
Sure, I can. And thank you so much for having us on your program today. A lot of what I can talk about is continuation on the themes of what Maurice was introducing as well. As you know, Howard was founded in 1867 by congressional decree during Reconstruction. And because of that, it has a post-Civil War mission to educate young black students and to train new black professionals in degrees that are relevant to the needs of the reconstituted United States, or Union. So it's first conceptualized as a theological seminary, but then is actually offered as a full range of programs, including a College of Arts and Science, a School of Divinity, and a College of Medicine. And music classes are offered in 1870, but it's not until 1892 that music teachers are begun to be trained. The school, however, the normal school, the teachers' college, was underfunded. There were low salaries for faculty, and there was low enrollment, and a lot of the professions were racialized. So musicians, classical musicians, space for African-American classically trained musicians and orchestras was very rare, and so black musicians were trained to be teachers. And it wasn't really until 1914 that a music department emerged from the theology department, and in a way that's an allusion to my title chapter, No Church Without a Choir, which is a quote from my interview with Fred Irby, who's the current director of jazz studies at Howard University. And for me, the title is somewhat an allusion to a celebratory and communal voice of a formal community in response to sort of a rule-bound doctrine, that there can be a call, but there's also a response. In 1918, under Lulu Vera Childers, who is the music director at Howard from 1905 to 1942, there's a formal school of music. And she was friends with Marian Anderson and invited Marian Anderson to perform at Howard, which also was a part of what led to her renowned performance at the Lincoln Memorial. In 1943, Howard is admitted to the National School of Music, but it's not until 1968, which is a very radical time not only for D.C., but for the world at large, that jazz studies is formalized at Howard.
Yeah, and I just was just curious, when did your interest in this history start for you?
Thanks for the question. I've been living in Bloomingdale for 5 years now, and I've been playing with the Howard University Orchestra for 4 years. But I moved to Washington, D.C. because I was completing my dissertation at the time, which looks at generally how U.S.-trained Africa scholars use their scholarship to advocate for U.S.-Africa foreign policy. So I started doing some research at Howard University, which was one of the first African studies program. So I had some familiarity with the archives there and some interest in Howard as an institution. And I got to know Maurice Jackson when I was working at NYU Washington, D.C., and he was invited to give a guest lecture. And we became friends. He read a lot of my drafts of my dissertation. And when it came to light that the volume for the Historical Society would be converted into a book, Maurice asked if I would consider writing a contribution as a chapter, and suggested a chapter on Howard. And as a member of their music program, and as someone who is familiar and very interested in the institution from a research perspective, I was really excited to be a part of the project. So I love living near Howard. I love being a part of the community there. It's, to me, such a wonderful institution and a great part of Washington, D.C.
Great. Thank you. And so I, digging down into the weeds a little bit on the text, outside of the narrative of the history, you think someone named Timothy McCake, the conductor at Howard U Symphony Orchestra, and...
Yeah, that's right. Tim
Maciek
is the conductor of Howard University Symphony Orchestra. I've been playing under him for 4 years. He's also a violinist with the Kennedy Center Opera House. For me, as a violinist, it's wonderful playing with a conductor who himself is a violinist. I've learned so much. He's also, for me, he introduced me to some incredible players and Howard-trained musicians like Adolphus Hailstork, who I write about, who's an African-American composer. He graduated from Howard University in 1963, and in the fall of 2015, we played his Sonata da Chiesa. I also write about pianist Raymond Jackson, who's a professor emeritus of music at Howard University. He came to Howard in 1977, and I had the honor of playing, accompanying Dr. Raymond Jackson during a piano solo that he gave with the Howard University Orchestra for our spring 2016 concert. I was literally brought to tears on the stage with my violin as he played his Beethoven Piano Concerto No. 4. And Dr. Jackson wrote his dissertation at Juilliard on piano music of 20th century Black Americans. And he wrote about Adolphus Hailstork as a musician who incorporated the histories of African American figures and events into his music. And he wrote about his music as an example of African American composers in their relationship with jazz music, which Dr. Jackson calls America's classical music, that African-American classical composers are often marked by improvisation, postmodernism, and other sort of bridge allusions to different genres.
Great, thank you. So I met you after one of the events with Maurice, but can you comment on what your perception has been of the response so far to the book? And I have a follow-up as well.
It's been wonderful. Just as Maurice said, when I told my peers that I was writing about Howard University and jazz music, there were a lot of question marks that popped up on people's expressions. And I hope that this chapter in particular celebrates the distinct contributions of Howard-trained musicians and the Howard Music Program, but also creates increasing awareness of the artistic contributions of Washington, D.C. as a whole. And people in Washington, D.C. really are very proud of the city. And as we all know, it's changing a lot right now. And we all really want to centralize the contributions of artists and make that a distinct part of D.C.'s makeup as we move forward as a city. It's so important to elevate artists as being very central to our mission moving forward. But it's been wonderful to have people in the audience have really great questions, and for me as a scholar, just to learn more and more about the music.
Yeah, and so that my follow-up is a little bit about this. So in my perception, something like history in D.C. or other cities where there's sort of a deep history, it's kind of all around us. And then jazz is maybe a segment of that history. And I feel like it's a project like this sort of engages our understanding more and engages us with that these stories and animates them a little bit more. So people are kind of vaguely aware of DC's history and vaguely aware of jazz history, not the experts we're talking to, but just sort of the general person. And then so this book is sort of like casts a light on this history. And so is that, do you feel like that's fair? Is that sort of one of the motivations or one of these occurrences? Is that, are you seeing this book engage people with in, as well as educate, or can you comment on that a little bit, either one of you?
I'll just say I do think that's fair. I think when you write about music, and we got this feedback, it was wonderful, from one of the editors from Georgetown University Press, that she so enjoyed editing our piece because as she was editing, she was looking up the artists and listening to them as she read. And I hope that it does open up people's conception of the city where we live. This is history, but it's also living history. And we often don't recognize the incredible contributions of the people who we're sharing a bus with, for example, that people in D.C. are really contributing incredible things to our community and to the world at large. And hopefully by reading books like this, people will appreciate, go out and see live music, take advantage of the multitude of free events that are in D.C. on any given daily basis. And I hope that when people read this book that they'll do like the editor did and open up whatever music platform they use and listen to the songs as they read it and discover more and more about the great music from this city.
Thank you. And Lauren has made some wonderful points. And I think also in her article, she points out the influence of jazz musicians, Donna Byrd, Benny Golson, the great Jerry Allen, others who played there. But, you know, one thing we want to do is this city is gentrifying rapidly. African Americans are being forced out of the city by the thousands, by the tens of thousands. The black population in 1957 became the first to become a majority black city, a major city. 57. By 1970, it was about 70%. But because of the enormous price of housing, because of all the problems that have existed in the city, the African-American population is just losing ground. Now about 47-48%. And many African-Americans cannot just afford here. Many others move into the city, many young whites, and nobody can decry that as long as they're willing to understand that people came here before them. But there's a rich culture. And so what's necessary and what we want to do is to use this book and thing to show people that this rich culture is a part of the vitality that made the city and for it to really resound. For example, when I came to Washington, there were African-American
and
theaters.
And when did you get here?
I came in the mid-70s, and then I left and I came back. And there were some African-American theaters. There were some African-American places to go, some African-American movie houses and places like that. There was an African-American theater company by Robert Hooks and Lou Goss and others. But all that's gone. and all the legacy of that is gone. A couple of years ago, Bohemian Cabins, which had been in existence since the 1930s, was closed, just willy-nilly just closed. And so there's a club that I know of owned by two Ethiopian sisters called Twins. There are a few night spots are open. There are some small places opening. But what we want this to be is a book that could show people the meaning of this, but also to open up other cultural venues. The city still is very segregated. I've been here a long time. I'm often told that in my house is one of the few where people of different races and colors come together and mix. We just don't have it. We work together by day, but by night we go in our same way. And so it's meant to bring together people to understand the culture, but also the vitality of this culture that we call the African American experience.
So I like thinking of the book as a way of preserving history and capturing the history. I like seeing the book that way. So as an archivist, I was pleased to see Michael Fitzgerald. He's the electronic services librarian at UDC. But so his section really just highlights the various historical collections in the city, special collections and archives, and Washingtoniana's mentioned there from DCPL and others. So I was really happy to see that light shed on these collections. So my question is coming from that and from an archivist and someone who's interested in history and jazz. So do you have a sense of you know, sort of scanning these different collections, how well documented the scene is or was? And is that something that could be determined with some degree of confidence?
Well, of course. For example, every record that's ever made is at the Library of Congress. They collect them.
Okay, check that box, done.
Larry Applebaum. Now, it's hard to get there. You have to really know the sources. Whenever I go to the library, you know, I'm trained in the 17th and 18th century, so I have to go in the archives a lot, sometimes 16th. So whenever I go in, I wear a necktie because people treat you better if you're an African-American man if you go in the archives with a necktie. So you just have to know. The Library of Congress is a folk life collection. And folk life is very, you know, the difference between that and old rhythm and blues and things that are very close. The Smithsonian has the full collection of the music of Duke Ellington, some 2,000 original songs. They have the instruments of Louis Armstrong, of Stan Getz. They have the dresses of Ella Fitzgerald. And the University of District of Columbia has the fascinating collection of Felix Grant, who was a dear man here in the 70s and 80s and 90s. He and his wife could be seen driving their Thunderbirds. They had matching Thunderbirds. And he collected Brazilian music.
And I think there's a picture of him in here, right?
There's a picture in here. And up the street, about three blocks away, is the All Souls Church. And All Souls Church was the church of the abolitionist John Quincy Adams when he defended the people in the Amistad case in 1848.
So it's a photo of him. I'm interrupting you. It's a photo of him with a giant stack of records. And he's smiling. He's also wearing a tie.
He's always wearing it, always a gentleman. And as he takes the music up, this is where the first Brazilian jazz music, samba, is played with Kida Best and Charlie Bird. And so Mr. Grant does it. And so they have the wonderful collection. And for example, I have a large collection of Cuban records, old Cuban records. Nobody. One day I'll give them to them. Other people have given collections. So you have all of those things. Howard University has a lot of manuscripts and things. But one problem with Howard is just going through such economic difficulties. It's somewhat hard to preserve them, but they have them. And other universities have these collections. A Catholic university has some of the early scores of black classicists. And so we hope that people will, you know, in this age of internet and YouTube and things like that, people don't often visit the archives as a physical place. Mm-hmm. And as I tell my students, especially working in the early period, once you smell that book of the 70s, once you look at it, that book that you can hardly touch, or you can go to the Shakespeare Museum. You can get all the early works of Shakespeare and the musicians who put his music together. I've seen the manuscripts. So it's a wonderful city for looking at original. And then, of course, all the great people like Benny Golson and Jerry Allen, the tapes of their music and their performances. When Jerry Allen does her senior performances, and I think Lauren speaks about it, but Rusty Hassan speaks about it in his record, they have all of those things. Roy Hargrove, all these great people who are part of the Howard experience, they have those archived somewhere at the university.
So it sounds like that people have made efforts to identify these, keep them and store them, and make them accessible. And Lauren, do you have any commentary on my question? Do you have any?
I would love to add and make a plug for, Maurice mentioned so many fantastic resources, and I would also like to add that the librarians want to talk to people who want to do research. I also thank Joellen El-Bashir. She's a curator at the manuscript script division at Moreland Springarn. The librarians at DCPL, in my experience, have been phenomenal. And also interviewing people. There are so many talented people who were a part of the history in D.C., this recent history. And I have been staggered by people's willingness to share their experiences. If you have questions and you have a genuine interest, I think it's an incredible gift to humanity to interview people, talk to people, write their histories down, go to the libraries and talk to your local librarian if you're interested. There's just incredible resources here. If you're a curious person in Washington, D.C., it's the best place to be. You can always learn about something new here.
And do you mind transitioning into Andrew White a little bit? He's sort of one of my favorite people here, not just because he sort of figures prominently in the D.C. jazz history. And he's been around here since the early 60s and graduated from Howard and played at the Bohemian Caverns and some other clubs. But you did get to speak to Andrew, who lives in Northeast. He lives near Brooklyn, I think. But can you talk about interviewing these people that are still around versus, consulting sources of people who have passed and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. Andrew White, I'm so grateful for his time, and he's really a gift to D.C. in particular, but to music at large. As you mentioned, he's a multi-instrumentalist, and he's had an incredible career spanning classical, jazz, rock and roll, experimental. He had his band, the JFK Quintet, that played at Bohemian Caverns. He played with Fifth Dimension, Otis Redding, Stevie Wonder, Weather Report. He's a classically trained oboe player, and what I write about in my chapter in particular, and as you mentioned at the beginning, I try to organize my chapter from the music origins, which are based in secular and classical music, through jazz, but Andrew really talked to me about the tension between having what he called a commercial versus a classical career. And Benny Golson also spoke about that, how he wanted to explore different genres, but didn't really find at the times when they were there in the 50s through early 60s, a very receptive climate. And Howard evolved, but there really was a lot of resistance to playing jazz. And Fred Irby spoke with me about how, in his view, people really didn't understand how to listen to jazz. That was something that needed to be taught explicitly, and that's part of jazz education. But Andrew White he was from D.C. He's been in D.C. As he said at our last reading at Busboys and Poets, he's always been in D.C. except for a few years when he commuted to Paris. So he was a 2006 gold medal honoree of the French Society of Arts, Sciences, and Letters, by the way. I mean, he's a world traveler. He's played jazz everywhere with pretty much everyone. And he's also recognized for his opus of transcriptions of John Coltrane and Charlie Parker. And he has his own company, Andrew's Musical Enterprises Incorporated. It's based in Northeast, where he sells transcriptions that he's written with his classical training. He's written out all of these Coltrane solos and performances. And as he was saying just the other day, the entire world has been very receptive of that. He went to Japan in the 70s and was treated like a celebrity there. But it's really incredible that people like Andrew White, have dedicated, he's dedicated his career and his life to being in D.C. And we're so grateful for it. And I'm so grateful that he spent the time speaking with me about his life and accomplishments.
Great. Thank you.
And I suggest one thing is that Rusty Hassan, in his article, he interviews many of the people. He talks about all the legends who've come through here. And many people like Lauren, like Mr. White, people like Shirley Horn, who was the just magisterial pianist and singer. Buck Hill was a great saxophonist. And so the book is about all those people from those different venues. Bill Harris, who played the blues. And the need for, the fact is that music is a hard business now, and musicians are really, in many cases, struggling unless they're at the very top of the line. Because with the streaming, I spend a lot of time with musicians lately, and they stream, with everything being streamed, CD sales and pretty much everything is going out. The clubs are not there. So really what musicians make it is the summer sessions where they go off and do the festivals. And some were lucky enough to be based at a university. But it's very difficult. That's why supporting the music is just so important.
Yeah, I agree. And just a reminder, we're talking about D.C. Jazz, Stories of Jazz Music in Washington, D.C., published by Georgetown University Press. And we're speaking to Maurice Jackson and Lauren Sinclair. And so we began by talking about this physical space here in Adams Morgan, and sort of my next question focuses on that, about these places. And I love the names of these places where people would go to hear music and where musicians would play. And so I have the Jungle Inn at 12th and U, Pigfoot or the Pigfoot at Rhode Island Northeast, Bohemian Caverns, of course, Abarts, which Andrew White talked about playing there, Blues Alley, Top of the Foolery, another favorite name of mine, Etc. Club. So I'm curious if you want to talk in the new thing, right? Can we talk about the new thing? That was a series, is that right? What was that?
All the clubs you mentioned, Etc. was a wonderful club. Top of the Foolery, Andrew White played a lot of Bohemian Cabins. The One Step Down, which is where I speak about where Reuben Brown, the great pianist, played. And they had a most wonderful jukebox. Right around the time of the riots, the 68 riot, right before then, there was a lot of tension. And a man named Topper Carew, who was an architecture student at Howard, and had been down south with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, wanted to do something about to bring young people together. So right around the corner, here in Adams Morgan, he found something called the New Things Art and Architectural Center. And they brought in kids, and there were great people like Alphonse Luzon, and great drummers, and Eric Gravatt, and masterful national musicians came there and gave sessions. The great Olatunji, the great Nigerian drummer of African polyrhythms, came there. And they had music classes and things there. In the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, maybe even the 80s, pretty much everybody who went to public school had a chance to be in an orchestra, a band, or there was some kind of band, a marching band or something. But somehow, especially with the budget cuts, the Reagan in the 80s, the 90s, now, very few public schools have bands, have public bands. They took two things out of the school. They took bands out, and so kids don't learn music. They learn to sing, maybe rap, but they don't learn musical structures. And they took out PE. And therefore, they took out PE, kids, the development of type 2 diabetes and things like that. But the new thing filled that vacuum, all volunteer. And it also laid the basis for the foundation of the Duke Ellington School of Arts, because that is where Mike Malone and others came from, and Peggy Kafis, the late Peggy Kafis, who just died, the great philanthropist. So the new thing brought all those things together, contributions, and then in those days they had a big blues festival, 68, 69, and things like that. It's before I came in, but I read about the festival. That was sort of revised, because there's a big blues festival they held yearly. Now there's the it just finished now, the DG Jazz Festival, which was phenomenal, which had venues all over the city.
Right, still active, it's still alive, it's still thriving, huh?
And so a lot of that comes out of community-based foundations like the new thing. There must be, the radio stations like this, WPFW, many others are just so important and so vital for the community and for survival of a culture.
Thanks, Maurice. I was going to add one more thing, and I think we're running out of time here. But I just want to say, we think about jazz cities. We think of New York City and Chicago, New Orleans, Maybe we throw Kansas City in there, but I don't think we put D.C. in there. And we is sort of the general American population. But, you know, having read this book and sort of through these events and talking to you, you know, I think that D.C. has a lot more of a dimension of jazz music than anyone out there would ever think. And I just sort of want to thank you for doing that. I think it's important for people to think of D.C. not just
and
as...
a lot of great young musicians coming out of D.C. now. David Murray has a new band called Class Struggle. He's a phenomenal saxophonist from Oakland. And he has two young guys, Carter, Russell Carter and Rashawn Carter, one bass one, who come out. Corcoran Hall, Ben Williams, the great bass player. So many young musicians are coming out of the city. The musicians always knew that Washington had great music. They always knew. And of course, you know, if you want to be a writer, a famous writer, you're probably not going to stay in D.C. You're going to go to New York. So we can't decry that. Somebody goes to New York. I came to D.C. and I wanted to get to New York and I just end up staying here. So I can't blame that. But it is a great place for music, great way station. We just have to make it more accessible.
Well, thank you. And Lauren, do you have any closing comment here?
Yeah, I would say as a musician myself, I've found D.C. to be a very receptive place and a very welcoming and inclusive place. And as someone who really appreciates music, I've found no shortage of venues that welcome all sorts of budding, highly talented performers. And I think it's my duty now to say, you know, I would really love to... have more audience, see more audience, especially for those who are now being trained at places like Howard, who will become the next big thing in music. So thank you. Thank you for having us on your program and supporting the book. It's really been a wonderful experience to share what we're learning about and writing about here.
Well, thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Maurice.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Lauren and Maurice. Thank you. And Ray, thanks for letting me join you on today's episode. Well, this has been an episode of All Things Local on Full Service Radio, broadcasted live from the Lion Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Please visit dclibrary.org to learn more about the library's services and programs. Talk to us online at DCPL on Twitter and follow us on D.C. Public Library on Instagram. Listen and download the show wherever you listen to your podcast by searching for Full Service Radio. Thank you and have a great day.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO. On Instagram and Facebook @Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.